Lindsay, have you heard the term tall man with giant watch?
I cannot say that I've ever heard that term. What is it?
You've worked in tech for how many years?
I've worked in HR for 20 years. Tech, probably 9 of those years.
Okay, so a tall man with a giant watch is a guy who is really tall and has a very expensive watch. He just kind of walks around being tall with his giant watch. It's just like an energy. This guy walks into a room and just everyone pays attention to him. He's never really struggled at anything. Probably grew up building computers in his parents' house, went to a public Ivy or an actual Ivy League school where he played a sport, dark-haired. You know what? Are you getting it? It's okay.
Yeah, no, now that you're describing the tall man with the giant watch, is that what it is? I know exactly the persona or the archetype that you're talking about. Just someone who has risen to their career heights via whatever channels they have, but with presumed relative ease, or, maybe like the storybook career arc or the storybook life. So, tall man, giant watch, probably lacking diversity. We don't talk about that.
No, the tall man with the giant watch is not just white. I see tall men with giant watches of all races. They're just all full of themselves. That's the commonality.
And are they always men?
Yes.
And is it always tech?
No, some of them are presidents. Hey everyone, I'm here with Lindsay Ducrose, who has worked in HR for 20 years and in tech for 9, has met several tall men with giant watches. She just launched a company called Pocket HR, which provides HR strategy and execution for small to mid-sized businesses. And in this episode, she's going to talk with me about these tech layoffs that have been permeating my LinkedIn feed and my Twitter and just everywhere. I think we should call this episode, "Hey Girl, What Should Tech Workers Do About All the Layoffs?" But I can workshop that. Most of the listeners for this episode are probably workers who've been affected by the tech layoffs. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of everything, do you have anything you'd like to say to people who have been impacted financially, emotionally, spiritually, in whatever way by a company they've worked for, letting go of them like they are tiny little balloons? No fanfare, just goodbye. Just an email in the middle of the night. You're no longer a part of our company. What do you have to say for them?
Well, emotionally, I myself have been part of a layoff, and it was a layoff from an organization I didn't really have a ton of passion towards, but was committed to success in my role and in my contribution there. Something that I think our generation has gotten better at, our parents' generation, not so much, but we're evolving past it, which is to not attach so much of your personal worth to a company. Right? You don't see the days when people are staying 20, 30, 40, 50 years and retiring at a company. I think we have evolved to disassociate or detach ourselves emotionally from organizations. That being said, there's never been, I think, a greater disconnect between the wages that we earn and our survival comfortably as compared to our parents' age, in which it costs less. And yes, the wages were less, but as a ratio, it was affordable. And now, if you don't have at least 3 to 6 months of your expenses in the bank and you get laid off, and you get laid off without a severance package, which happens, unfortunately, and terribly. But when that happens, your survival is now in jeopardy. So it can trigger all kinds of emotions. I just want to say to any listeners, you have a skill set. An industry does not define your skill set. Your skill set, and we can talk more about this, is what you produce. It's not your job title, and it is how you go about producing it. And that is a skill that is transferable across industries, across organization sizes, across operating budgets, and most likely across cultures and international lines as businesses become more global and technology does speed up our innovation and comprehension of other languages. So I guess my empathetic side says, let yourself grieve that experience, but let it be brief and focus your energy on the lessons and challenges you did overcome in that role because they all have them. And to also challenge yourself forward into not staying in an industry that is so volatile. I think finance, technology, media, these are the industries that have had significant spikes in layoffs since 2022, and this has been happening since 2022. Today, I read a statistic that was in May 2024, we've already had 60,000 tech layoffs. you probably are more likely than not to be impacted by a layoff if you work for a large company that can only see movement in its bottom line with large actions. So you are a tiny balloon in one sense, and becoming untethered can actually create more opportunity for you moving forward, as long as we don't continue to define ourselves by the name of the company that we work for.
You know, when you work for a company, there's a big push, I would say at most of them now, to make it part of your identity while you're there. So you say don't make work your identity. But the fact of the matter is, when you are working for a company, especially a technology company, you are not only encouraged to make your workplace your identity, there are real consequences for not doing so. People who work for the people that get really far ahead are people who make it their whole identity. They are wearing shirts. They are saying things like design thinking is going to change everything and fix it. Like, they are bought into the whole machine of the company. If you don't do this, it's not you'll get fired or let go or whatever, but you are not going to make it as far. If you look at the top executive, like, I've met some people who are at the top level of that company. They live, breathe, sleep. Everything about their life has to do with. So you're at a company like this. And I don't think media and finance, I don't think it's quite like that there. Like, media, people work in media. It's more about the story. It's okay to push back against your company. And in fact, sometimes it's encouraged because that creates an interesting story. Finance, people work in finance. It's all about money. No one really has, I feel like, any loyalty to their company. And people are fine with it. It's like, oh, you got a better offer there. Well, we'll match it. And if we can't, we understand. When you're at a tech company, I feel like you're encouraged to see yourself as part of a family more than you are for other industries. So you say not to make it your identity. But I feel like how far you can make it in a tech company hinges on your ability to make it your identity. What do you think about that?
I think there's external presentation of identity. So you mentioned the shirts, the lanyards, the hats, the posts, those sorts of things. It is very off-putting when it is insincere, right? I have not worked for a company in my career that just looks at that as the only redeemable value or value in an employee, is just how much of a cheerleader they are. Showing up with passion, as long as it's sincere passion for a brand or a brand's mission, does take you further than someone who is a brilliant jerk. I worked with a mentor in a past life in a previous job who said, we don't want to employ brilliant jerks here. So when you look at the culture of a place, when you see people who are diehards and who are loyal, if you unpack that and if you peel that onion a little bit, you'll probably find that they are attached, at least the ones who are contributing and providing value to the organization, you'll generally find that they're attached to a value set or a mission or something that maybe is founder driven or a principle of the company. As a founder or as a small business leader or CEO, I would encourage everyone to think about how their values and what they celebrate and tolerate defines the workplace and defines their engagement with their employees and their retention level. So things like, oh, we're a family here. Well, fam can be a triggering word for people. Families come with lots of past baggage. And I think people use the term family as interchangeable for loyal, committed, understanding. Again, I think it's one of those things you have to be mindful of if you're saying we are a family here. What does that mean? Because a lot of people did not grow up with families that have a positive connotation of families. I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family like that, but I never would ever expect an employer or want my employer to approach me in a way that a family dynamic situation worked. So if you see people who are like cheering the company line and they're rah-rah in the conference room and basically a kiss, you know, for all intents and purposes, you can generally sniff those people out pretty quickly and determine what's sincere versus what is being used as a strategy to try to get ahead.
I'm going to put it like this. Every single person I have ever met in my life who has been like that at a company has been very willing to switch over for more money to a different company. I cannot personally think of anyone, even if they've been sincere in their love for a company, who has not been willing to flip over to another job for significantly more money, which is not how you approach actual families, Lindsay. Like, someone was like, you've got a beautiful daughter and you're your very handsome husband. If someone came up to you and was like, hey, I could give you more money, I would give you a salary raise if you came over to my family. You're not going to say yes to that, right?
No, me personally, no. However, some people do this.
You said some people do this. Like, have you, would you just experience someone going to a different family for more money?
I don't have any statistics to back this up because I'm not in divorce court. However, people do leave spouses for opportunistic gain, right? But that's not what we're talking about here.
No, actually, that's a really good analogy. Yeah, right. And when we see people do that with their families, quite rightfully, I think, you know, if we see someone leave their spouse for someone who makes a lot more money or whatever other reason someone might want to upgrade, we see that person as a terrible human. Generally speaking, they are not received kindly by their community. However, when it comes to companies, someone's like, yeah, I'm going to make 70 more K over at this company. I'm switching. I'm hopping. Oftentimes, they're kind of plotted by their company. The company is like, good, we want you to make more money. I just don't really feel like there's ever any negative reception to that. So all I'm trying to say is, while I have definitely had jobs where I've loved the company's mission and I felt passionate about it, I've never seen any company I've worked for as a family. And I think that's kind of a good thing. I think that's a healthy boundary to set. I've really liked people I've worked with. I have supported people I've worked with outside of the company, right? I've babysat for people I've worked with because I cared about them. But I think there's a level of professionalism that's important to maintain. What do you think about that?
I could not agree more. I think that when you use language that is so full of assumptions and individual experience, like family, that's non-specific language, or it's hyper-specific to the individual that's hearing it. You blur the lines of intention with that person. And let's be honest, most of us work to earn a living, to further a career, to contribute to society in ways that a job affords us to. One of my recent friends who, well, he's a longtime friend, but recently just got a job after a year of searching. And he called me and he said, I finally got a job offer, and he's got 20 plus years of experience. He had been on the market for a year, and he said, everyone deserves a job. Everyone deserves a job. It is a dignified thing to have a job, because a job can give you purpose. It gives you value. It gives you outcome. It gives you a function beyond the home. But keeping the lines blurred between family, or making sure the lines don't become blurred between family and your profession, I think allows for more focused output in both of those environments. So COVID hit and we're all working from home. I worked with my spouse from home for a year, and that presented a whole different set of challenges where we could neither focus on each other and our personal relationship or work fully. It was overlapped and it was blending. And so COVID kind of forced the family and professional overlap. I don't know very many people that want that. You know, I also know people who have family businesses where it truly is a family business. And sometimes decisions, the right decisions, don't get made because somebody wants to spare another person's feelings or another person's impact or outcome. I think that whenever companies say, oh, we're a family here, you just have to unpack that. And professionalism does not mean that you're cold and stoic and don't care. I think that those words, again, are used as synonyms, or professional versus family. It's not a versus. You can be professional and still have a kind, caring environment that values loyalty. If you value loyalty, what is your rewards and recognition program? What milestones are you giving folks incentives to hit? Your practices should reinforce what your values are, not words. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that we should be careful with the words that we choose, and we shouldn't blur those lines. We should just be intentional with what we mean behind them, because I can make professional decisions that are hard, like layoffs, but I can still do it in a caring and compassionate way, similar to how I might tell a 25-year-old child who's still living in my house, hey, I love you. Here's some seed money. I want you to go out and try to make it. That's not a layoff of the home per se, but you can release employees and family in a kind and thoughtful and invigorating way. And a lot of companies just don't do that. So tragically, you know, you get an email in the middle of the night that says your card's not going to work tomorrow, or worse, you show up to work and your card doesn't work to get you into the building. Right now, with such a remote workforce and displaced workforce, email often is, or Zoom or Slack or whatever the media is used to do that. I still think everyone deserves a personal touch, like a personal call from somebody who it would make sense to tell them the news.
Interesting you mentioned that. Some questions for you. Before we really dive into the tech layoffs that have been happening in 2024, let's do some maintenance questions. Lindsay, what is a layoff and how is it different than just a regular firing?
You can look up these terms on SHRM or Google or whatever.
You are Google here, Lindsay. Now, tell in your words, what is layoff? No outside resources. One-stop shop podcast interview, Lindsay. Come on, Lindsay. Tell me what a layoff is.
Okay, a layoff is when an organization makes a decision to eliminate more than one position, I would say. And it can be position elimination, it can be role elimination, it can be restructuring, it can be full reorganization of the company, it can be cutbacks. You make a short-term cut in favor of being able to pivot more quickly for long-term success. So this is why you'll see companies that have layoffs and then still have job postings on their site, because they have inflated too much in the near term and they need to make short-term cuts to reinvest that money into their strategic goals and objectives moving forward. That might be profit margin growth, that might be stock pricing, that could be investment in other research and development or other future technologies, especially in the tech space. It could be oversaturation in the marketplace because maybe you now have five competitors when you used to just have one or none. There's a post-pandemic problem that is well documented and researched that is that companies misread the panic around COVID and the frenzied buying and consumer spending habits, and they staffed up for what they thought was the new normal when things have returned or are starting to return to a pre-COVID environment in terms of spending. So they bloated, they reacted. And they hired way too many folks. And now that consumer behavior is starting to shift again back into a different pre-COVID era or even into a different AI-focused era, you have these companies that now have all of these people that they had hired to meet the demand during COVID when people were purchasing online much more frequently because they were forced to or they had to. They didn't want to get out. So layoffs are company decisions that relieve financial pressures, and staff cost being one of the biggest financial investments that a company can make in the short term to invest dollars elsewhere or to improve shareholder figures.
So it sounds to me that layoffs are more about companies accidentally overhiring and then correcting and letting go of more than one employee or groups of employees. Can there ever be layoffs for other reasons besides overhiring?
Absolutely. There can be layoffs for company strategic initiatives, company strategic redirection. Let's say an organization wants to get into a different line of business, but they don't have operating budget to be able to do that. So they need to save, and they do that by cutting one department or one group of individuals and reinvest in hiring a different skill set. As cold as that sounds, their strategic advantage sometimes, it's kind of like a budget. When you decide that you want to purchase a car, you may cut your restaurant budget for 12 months because you need to reinvest that money into getting adequate transportation or the vehicle that you want. That's how an organization's budget is set. And unless you're going to go out and get additional investment or financing, you're going to have to play with what you've got. You have a finite number of dollars. And another thing that happened was the interest rates during COVID were so high, or they are increasing, that it became harder for tech companies to get that money to make all of these investments. They could not get loans as easily as they had been because interest rates were really high. So it didn't make sense to borrow money. So therefore, they're going to look in their current wallet and say, what money do I maybe not need right now so that I can compete in this space? That would be another reason why a company does a layoff. Another reason is just it is maybe indicative of a really poorly run business. I mean, there are plenty of businesses who literally just go out of business. And in those situations, they may not shutter completely, but they will reduce their staff down to the absolute only essential functions. I worked at a company where that happened recently, and it was really sad to eliminate 90% of the roles in the organization, keeping only about 10% of the staff to continue the business. But it was necessary for the brand to thrive and to survive, as hard as it was. So again, companies do this for different reasons. You mentioned earlier, you asked a question about the difference between a layoff and firing. Typically, the word fire is associated with poor performance or bad conduct or bad behavior or a violation of a policy of some sort. It's usually not a company strategic decision. It's usually a reactive decision to a type of infraction or policy violation or something like that. So I don't know. I don't really like the word fired because it does imply that somebody did something wrong, especially when they're interchanged between layoff and firing. Because in layoffs, typically there's no fault on the employee side. essentially the company made a decision.
Yeah, I don't really like that word either. I've noticed when people in higher up positions get fired, generally they're given a little bit of warning so they can resign. When you see a very successful CEO resign from their position, they got fired. They're just allowed to say, oh, I resigned. Yeah, Lindsay says there's a practice called resignation to avoid termination. Oh yeah, I remember what I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you about all those companies that took out the pandemic loans and then laid off a bunch of employees anyway. Actually, I don't think I can name names because I don't want to get sued, but you know me. I love to read and investigate and learn. And I was looking at all those companies and how much money they took out during the pandemic. And there were quite a lot of them that laid off employees. It's actually one company I'm thinking of that laid off like 99% of their employees. I'm not affiliated with them. I've never worked for them. I had a friend that worked for them and had a bad experience. I was looking them up. And agency, obviously, you're not going to be able to work during the pandemic. They laid off the majority of their employees and got $500,000 of pandemic loans. So when you talk about it being a financial decision that's strategic, it sounds like it's just about getting more money for them. It's not necessarily about furthering the company to help other people. So tell me, what do you think about that?
I do know that there was a lot of fraud committed around these, and there was an audit practice that followed in 2023, in which companies who applied for the PPE loans had to basically demonstrate how they used those dollars. So when there's free money to be given out from anyone, you're going to have abusers of that process. I can't really talk about the intentions of why somebody would take this money other than just for pure survival of the business. And survival of the business means survival of the shareholders' investments, if there are shareholders, or the investors' investments. So it does go back to the bottom line. And if you get a loan, and you can get a loan from the government for $500,000, $1 million, I think it was dependent on headcount, then you can theoretically, hopefully, survive longer as a business, right? That was the purpose of the loan, so that it would get you through pandemic times. And then to apply for forgiveness of that loan, you had to go through lots and lots and lots of different hoops and audits in order for that loan to be forgiven by the government, essentially, because most people spent it. I don't have any statistics on the PPE loan, but it would be a fascinating thing to look at. What percentage of companies actually used it? How did they fare in the pandemic? And what was the outcome? How long did they retain their staff? What practices did they put in place to prevent future failures? A lot of companies don't operate on a ton of cash flow.
Yeah, I think we are going to look back and see the money companies took as a great scam. So, Lindsay, tell me, why is the tech industry experiencing so many layoffs right now? Are they cutting blow? Is it AI? Is it outsourcing workers to the Philippines? Just tell me.
And this is specific to the tech industry. I want to be specific. So the unemployment rate is actually just as high, if not a little higher, than it's been in 50 years. That is overall. That's considering every industry that's hiring. More jobs have been created than jobs have been lost in Q1 of 2024. So overall, there's growth. In the tech industry specifically, and I mentioned this earlier, but you're looking at a pretty flooded market. We've been doing this for like 23, 24 years now, right? You're looking at an adoption rate of consumers that pretty much everybody has a phone or a computer, you know, if you're looking at US consumers. There's a piece of technology in almost everyone's home. So you don't have this rapid acquisition of technology that you did that was fueling the economy and the tech industry back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and even like 2010s. So you've hit a saturation point. So you're seeing some of that level out. The tech industry also has this, I don't want to call it a condition. It's not a condition, a behavior rather, that is like a waterfall effect. So when I'm Google or when I'm one of the big four and I see another company that's in the big four doing a layoff and I see what happens to their stock price, because keep in mind, when these layoffs happen, there's a stock price increase. Shareholders are really happy. They see that. Well, if I'm another big four company and I'm on a board of that company, I'm going to say, hey, why don't we do what they did? And they were the ones to rip the Band-Aid. So we're just following suit. And then we can tack on the narrative of, oh, tech industry is getting hit again. You know, so there is this social behavior that happens in certain tech companies. I do think that AI is impacting the efficiency with which we do our jobs. I don't know that it's going to replace one-to-one, but it is going to create efficiencies and gains that will in turn theoretically produce more revenue for an organization, but TBD on if they're going to use that revenue to hire more people, right? When you're in an industry that completely is surviving on speed and speed to acquire this new technology or this new innovation, you're never going to have stability. You get one or the other, like working for the government. They're not known to be fast. They're stable jobs, but they're not known to be really fast and innovative. Tech, on the other hand, is incredibly fast and incredibly innovative. And if you can't keep up, you're going to eventually become outdated or worse, obsolete if you don't pivot your business. So stability is not really a fair expectation to put on yourself if you're in the tech industry. For one, just stability in general, speed and stability typically are opposites. So AI, possibly, it's going to make things efficient. And I honestly think that project management software is probably going to make redundant the role of manager in companies. So now you're seeing companies that are letting go of middle management, because if you look at middle management, what are they actually doing? What value are they offering to the organization other than delegation and project management of deliverables? If you've got a software that can do that and allow people to operate independently and contribute independently while you have a software keep track of deliverables and keep you on task on time, then you have to repurpose the role of a manager and you have to redefine its value to the organization. So I can't remember which company just did this, but there was a layoff, I think in a tech company recently, where they really focused on the middle management layer and provided structure for people to self-manage, which is an interesting experiment.
So tell me, Lindsay, how do tech companies typically handle layoffs? You've told me some stories. Normally, by the way, Lindsay and I are friends. Normally, I don't discuss stuff I'm going to talk about the podcast before the podcast because, like, I want you to learn along with me. But I did with Lindsay, and she told me some really incredible horror stories about tech company layoffs. I'm not sure which one she can share publicly on the podcast, so I'm going to leave it with her to decide which ones she wants to tell you.
This is going to sound terrible, and I don't mean it to, but I have fortunately been a part of delivering some successful layoff experiences. I won't participate in unless I'm creating the experience for the individuals, which usually includes a one-to-one conversation with somebody who it's going to be meaningful coming from to the employee who's impacted by the layoff decision. It includes a highly curated narrative and time for processing the information, lots of follow-up, lots of resources for that person, and as much transparency as I can share responsibly in treating them like a human. Now, of course, we have all heard about the instances in big tech where people walk up, because in layoffs, if you terminate over a certain percentage of your workforce within a certain job site, you trip what's called the WARN Act, W-A-R-N, like WARN, and you have to post about it before it happens. And you have to do it within a certain time period before it happens. So I think it might be 60 days or so. I would need to pull up the exact regulation. But most of these companies, the reason you hear about the layoffs in the first place is because they've tripped a WARN Act and they have to post about it in the newspaper or in some sort of public-facing publication because it could have local economic impact. Typically, people know if there's going to be a layoff happening, and they're on pins and needles for 1 month, 2 months, however much time the company gave them to know. So there's already anticipation and fear. During that period, you'll see some people self-select out because maybe they were on their way out, or maybe they don't want to be impacted by a layoff, or maybe they're retiring. Those are best case scenarios because then theoretically your layoff impact, the dollar impact shrinks because they've self-selected out of the organization. In other organizations where they don't, or where the market is really weird, like right now, the market is very strange for job seekers. A lot of people aren't leaving. There are jobs posted, but I'd say not a lot in tech. When companies need to right-size their organization to meet, you know, short-term gains and needs, depending on the size of the layoff, that generally drives how you do it. And if you are spread out, if you have remote workers, how are you going to do those? They're going to be virtual, making sure, you know, you have your cameras on, things like that, as humanely as possible. And with as much integrity and dignity as possible, I think is important. One particular layoff recently that happened in the industry, and this was given to me secondhand by individuals who worked there, was that the office had been having these, call it death by a thousand paper cuts, where you have these little miniature layoffs well, 5 positions here, 10 positions there, 3 positions here. If that happens enough times, people will see your strongest talent, the talent you don't want to leave, will see the writing on the wall and look at leadership as lacking in their ability to make strong, decisive action to provide stability in the ship. This had been happening for a while, a couple of years. And then finally, one day, I think there were only about 30 people left in the office. Somebody found the office itself, the office space, listed on the real estate website.
Can you say it for my listener?
No, we shouldn't say it.
She said we shouldn't say it.
You know, I don't think it's public or private, but essentially this was... A little bit of cart before the horse. The office space was posted and listed on the real estate website, and somebody who was currently employed in that office, in that space, saw it and said, hey, so I guess we're losing our office space. Are we losing our jobs too? And then shortly thereafter, they had the largest round of layoffs and then eventually released out the space. And that is just indicative of a company that is too big to coordinate the moving parts and does not have efficient practices in place to be able to thoughtfully think about the experience of the employees who are going through this. All it requires is some orchestration and some curation of a thoughtful response. And companies that are that big often go straight to logistics. They don't go into the emotions or the experience. They just go straight to logistics. And that's unfortunately probably what happened, but that's an assumption. Safe one though.
So this company, and you know, there are other companies, of course, that will do several rounds of small layoffs, 5 workers, 10 workers. Is that to avoid tripping the WARN Act?
That is a very strategic question of you, Paige. I don't know. I mean, if you thought about that just now, then it's not too far off to think that other companies may be keeping this in mind as well. Honestly, in my experience, when I've seen these small cuts, it is because the organization truly believes that they are this close to the next deal, or they're this close to the next investment. Or if we can just get this product launched, we're going to be able to bring in this much revenue. That sounds very forgiving of the people who are making the decisions. But in most instances where I've been involved in those processes, it has been driven by you want to cut as little as possible and still manage the business forward affordably. The problem is when somebody can't see the forest for the trees, or they can't predict too far down the road, maybe they only have a line of sight of 3-6 months. So they're hoping that XYZ lands, or they're hoping this product changes for them, but it's a bunch of hopes and what ifs. So a lot of times when you see those trickle effects, it's because big change isn't happening and needs to happen.
Interesting. When I've seen companies do the small layoff, it's never just one layoff. What is the slogan for the chips, the stack chips? I don't eat junk food because I want to be thin for my entire life. Pringles. It's like, you can never eat just one Pringle. You can never, Lay's potato chips. You can never just have one Lay's. It's like layoff. It's like, you can never just lay off one employee. You're going to have to lay off the whole bag.
Lay off the whole bag. TM, trademark it by Paige.
I don't want to have that trademarked. Oh my God, that's like on airplanes. There's a whole thing where it's like if an airplane runs an ad next to, I think it's like if like a car crash happens or something kind of accident, airplanes don't run their ads next to them because less people fly. I don't want to be associated with layoffs. I want people to Google my name. They just see Paige Harriman, Climate Detectives, Paige Harriman, podcast that's successful. I don't want to see Paige Harriman. Lay off your employees like a bag of chips.
It's not funny. I will course correct. No, I've just not ever heard the analogy of, you know, the death by 1,000 paper cuts to Lay's bag of chips. But you're right. It is rarely just one layoff, because the reason you are having a layoff is because there is a financial gap, and it's rarely going to be solved with a few months of salary relief. Because you think about it, somebody's salary, we think about the salary as an annualized figure, but it really comes down in a budget to a monthly operating expense. So you break that salary down by 12 months. And let's say that 3 months from now, you really hope you can rehire. That's only, you know, That's only 3 months of somebody's salary. So if you are just looking to get by for three more months, there's something bigger that you're not seeing in the finances of your business, or you're just trying to time it to where you can get a stock boost or a profit margin gain so that you can instill hope or action into investors. So there's a financial play with it. It feels very inhumane, and that's because it is a numbers exercise.
Speaking about, you know, being humane and inhumane, I have some friends who got laid off and they were told by email. And I've had friends who've had their hands held while they're being laid off. If I'm going to be totally honest, if it were me, I would not want the fanfare. I'd much rather have the email and a severance package than I would a party and handhold. There's no fun way to get laid off. But I feel like when you talk about humane and inhumane, I just ultimately don't think it matters that much. I don't think it really impacts how someone feels. I know we're not in agreement on that. Can you tell me why?
Know that we're in disagreement on that. The factors that I'm considering are based on the layoffs that I've executed in organizations and the feedback that I've gotten from people who have left the company. I think what demonstrates more humanity, dignity, respect, integrity is what happens after the layoffs. With those impacted by the layoffs, I was very fortunate enough to work early in my career for a company here in Austin called GSD&M. We had to do the biggest layoffs in the company's history at the time, and that was due to a client, a massive client, the main client, deciding to go with another agency. And the advertising industry is known for volatility. It is a decades-old problem in the industry, but this was just a really large account that left. What we did as an organization was we said, we are going to, and this was back in, 2009, I want to say. We said, anybody who's lost their job, we will hold resume writing workshops, interview workshops. We actually flew in recruiters from agencies all over the U.S. and held a career fair for impacted employees. We held discussions with employees who maybe lost a long-term coworker of theirs in the reduction and the layoff, and how to navigate the new working landscape in the company with fewer employees. And so it was more about the recovery period than it was about the breaking the news. Because I think you're right. You can't solve for every single person's preference. You just have to be led by your values. It needs to be a consistent practice for everyone who's going through it. I've also heard about people bringing in everybody who's impacted into a conference room and just telling them all at once, it's you. You are the ones being let go. I could not imagine getting the call that you need to come to this conference room at this time and then having to walk to the conference room. On the flip side of that, there may be some camaraderie in looking around the room and seeing how many people or who might also be receiving the same news. But every single person is going to process it differently because everyone has a different set of responsibilities outside of the workplace that are driving their reaction. If you're laying off thousands of employees, it may not just be feasible, and it might be better sooner rather than later to let people know. And by email is generally one of the fastest ways to do that. It is impersonal. I would say how you recover after that and how you follow up and how you extend your customer service beyond the employment relationship will go a lot further than just, the impact of the news, because it's going to be shocking regardless, unless you're expecting it.
Talking about layoffs, we see AI reduce jobs, specifically jobs for Americans. America is objectively the best country to start a small business in. It is one of the only countries where the government can't just take your business. The trade-off to that is you have to create jobs for Americans. It's no good to do layoffs and then a month later invest everything in AI. It makes me really mad when I see stuff like that. How do you feel about it?
The cost drivers are usually what is dictating that. We can accomplish this, and it's usually task-based things. Well, we know that AI is taking over task-based things. Wilbur has a point of view on AI.
Oh, yeah. So Lindsay and I are drinking coffee in my living room, and my dog is here. He loves Lindsay, and he's just perked up. He is like, yeah, AI. Wilbur, you gonna replace me, Paige? Gonna get a robot dog? It's not gonna be the same. He's smiling about it. He knows he can't be replaced.
Yeah, I think that AI, you have to look at the cause of that. One of the advantages is the cost decrease. We know that, but we also know there are trade-offs, as I mentioned before. With AI probably becoming more of the task-oriented tool for leaders, your earlier point about hiring U.S. workers, it is increasingly expensive to live here in the US, and that is what drives up the salary demands. The cost of living is no joke. The cost of living, one could say, or the cost of consumption in the US is really what's driving this affordability crisis, and companies are no less impacted by it. So that being said, I haven't looked at profit margin statements from any tech companies as of late. So TBD on if companies are making even more money now than they were before. But I do know that salary costs increasingly go up. I think in 2022, 23, the inflation rate was like 9.1%. And in previous years, it had been between 3.5 and 5. So there's definite, you know, facts to the fact that it's getting more expensive to live here. And so people need to make more.
Yeah, it's no secret that everything costs more. I mean, I just as a general rule, try to see things positively and just be grateful that I live in a country where I am free to buy whatever I want. I have noticed that it is getting harder to buy what I want. I went to a coffee shop, Lindsay. Went to a coffee shop in East Austin and it was $9 for a latte. And, you know, that was with a dollar tip. And I was like, oh.
You could charge $12 for yours. Paige's lattes.
Would you pay $12 for a latte from me?
For you, Paige.
Tech companies in other countries could be just as good at making lattes as I am. Probably not. I have more experience. Definitely worth $12. That's what my humanities degree got me. Lindsay, what should the tech workers do now? Where should they go? Should they try to go to other tech companies or should they try to learn new skills?
So what should tech workers do now? Again, I'll go back to maybe this coming full circle in that your skill set transcends your industry. Now, there are job titles like engineer, software architect that are specific to the tech industry, but you also have product manager, project manager. You've got your back office functions, HR, finance, accounting, communications, marketing. A lot of these tech companies have roles and skills that are applicable in lots of different industries. Tech has just been notoriously high paying because it was a commodity that then became a necessity. And so that drove demand. But now that we have an adoption rate with technology and people can be more picky and choosy, you're seeing the competition spread and flatten a bit. That being said, the big four still the big four. You could probably expect a similar experience at any of those places and the same type of volatility. Again, you have to make big moves to make big changes and big swings in your bottom line. So the advice I would give on what tech workers should do now, especially if they've recently been laid off, is to focus on the skills you've acquired, the challenges you've overcome, the difficult personalities you've worked with and maintained strong relationships or productive relationships with, and market that skill. I often wonder if it would be an interesting experiment to design your resume around skills and not titles or company names. So if anyone out there listening would do an experiment like that where they build a resume and they don't put company names or previous titles on it, it does require a recruiter or an applicant tracking software, which does the screening, let's be honest, to look at your skills, to look at your contributions. And I would encourage you to communicate your value to a future organization in those terms as well. So here's the value I brought to this project. Here is the impact I had on that line of business, or here's the impact I had on that team. Here's what I learned. Those sorts of things transcend industries. So get creative with opportunities that you're looking at. Think of alternate job descriptions. You know, the tech industry is infamous for creating their own titles for things. At its core, you probably have a skill that is very transferable to another industry. And so if you like the pace and you like the subject matter and you don't mind the volatility, keep looking in tech, keep searching, but just know that speed and stability often are two sides of a magnet. It's something you just have to adjust to. Same with the advertising industry and any industry that has to catch up.
I got a little story about the advertising industry for you, Lindsay.
Let's hear it.
When I was 11 years old, my mom had this friend that worked in advertising, and Blockbuster was his client. This is right before Blockbuster. This is right around the time when Netflix came out. Sorry to date myself. I'm in my 30s, listeners. And my mom was on the phone with him and they were just talking about it. And he was like, how can we make Blockbuster a cool place for people to go, right? How can we compete with Netflix? And I said, well, why don't you have them deliver pizzas with movies? Because Netflix can't do that. And that would be cool to have a little cafe or something at Blockbuster. And he took that idea. He was supposed to pay me on it and he didn't. So all the little entertainment things you see at Blockbuster, little before they shut down, like the milkshake bar, the popcorn thing, that was because of me. Directly because of me. And I wasn't paid on it. And it was such a souring experience. This is real. This is truly real. You can ask my mom or the ex-wife of this advertising executive, Pam Kripke, and they will confirm it for you. So I was responsible for that. And you know, Lindsay, I gotta say, when Blockbuster went bankrupt and shut down all of its little franchises, I was really happy. I was like, that's right. That's what you get for not paying me. It was $8,000 would have been a lot. Anyway, that soured me on the advertising industry. Lindsay says, where did you get $8,000? So the guy's name originally agreed to give me 10% because it was my idea. It was a verbal agreement. It wasn't written, but also taught me, everybody, you got to get everything in writing. When it comes to this kind of stuff, I'm very aggressive about like, yeah, get it in writing. And it's because of this experience. Lindsay's got her eyes open. Yeah, I was responsible for the Blockbuster Entertainment Centers. That was me, Paige Harriman, my idea.
At 11 years old, and maybe that could have catapulted you into a career in advertising and marketing if you were already such genius at 11 years old. But instead, it soured you because of this malintended person who didn't make good on their word.
I would not ever refer to myself as a genius in any way. I was a little spacey child. I was just very imaginative. And I think he probably did me a favor. My feeling of it was like, okay, if you are a big name industry executive in your 40s and you are so desperate that you have to steal ideas from 11-year-old girls, that can't be a good industry to be in. Cannot be a good industry.
11-year-old girls are consumers too, I suppose.
Well, last thing I'll say about that, he came to speak at my little brother's elementary school, like I think a year-ish later. And he was talking about, it was like, you know, when parents come to work and they tell kids what they do for a living and the kids will ask questions. He was like, do you have any questions? I didn't ask him to do this. And my little brother raised his hand. He's like, yeah, what are you going to pay my sister?
That's classic. Cheers to your brother. Look, it takes advocacy. You got to have a village to advocate around you too. Way to go, Paige's brother.
Yeah, I didn't get any money. Nothing for me. I don't know. I think about like industries that are good to work in or not good to work in. Lindsay, you know how I feel about advertising. How do you feel about tech? What is your feeling around tech and people staying in tech long term? If you're going to advise someone who's been laid off from a tech company, and I think we talk about bad stuff with layoffs, there's a little bit of power to in a layoff because you're usually given a bit of a severance package. You have a no-fault reason for seeking a new job, so it's not really hard to explain to new employers. Do you think they should stay in tech, or should they try to pivot and find a new industry to work in?
I think that depends entirely on that person's disposition and perseverance and comfort zone. So I don't know that you're going to succeed long-term in tech if you are uncomfortable in innovation, ambiguity, pushing new technologies forward. And like I said, that presents a lack of stability because you have to be fast. So some people are built for tech and some people are just not. It's kind of interesting to think about the fact that there has been so much money in the tech industry. And so when the tech industry consumes a city that a lot of people want to move to, I'm not sure what came first, like the chicken or the egg here, you know, like Austin, which is where I've been since 2001 and have seen the city evolve into this Silicon Hills or this tech hub. A lot of times people will move for that industry specifically, especially if that industry is so prominent. But we have a lot of other sectors here too, like healthcare, government, arts, not as much as like Houston or Dallas, but not-for-profits, education, higher education, a lot of other opportunities here. And like I said, skills are transferable across industries. So if you want something more stable, but maybe a little less pushing the boundaries of what's possible from a technology standpoint, there are tons of other opportunities that you could seek. So it just depends on where you are personally in your life right now. And I call this the employee value proposition. What you're looking for in your life may not match up at a certain time with what a tech company can offer. So while the big four might offer a really large paycheck, you may be at a point in your life where you have other revenue streams or independently wealthy, or you just don't need to increase your salary. You may choose to not take a role at a company just for pay. You may look at other things like culture, community, career growth. And by career growth, I mean career growth up, out, peer to peer. here, I mean, growth is not just upward. Growth can also be inward. And so you may look for an organization that provides you with more of those sorts of forms of compensation, or maybe you are looking for healthcare benefits because you have a child who has special needs. And so for you, you're willing to take a pay cut for better health insurance, or maybe you need to go somewhere that has the very best insurance and you're willing to compromise in other areas of what you expect from your employer. So I would just encourage anyone listening to not place so much of their individual happiness on their employer. Yes, most of us need a paycheck to live, but at the end of the day, they are a company. They make decisions. The decisions are mostly based financially, unless you are purely a not-for-profit business, but even non-profit businesses do have to have an operating budget to be able to pay their workers. So it's just much lower than typically a for-profit business. Sometimes those employees are much happier because there is a sense of stability. There is a sense of mission-driven, values-driven work. There is some community engagement that does fill a different cup in your soul outside of your wallet, but it depends on where you are in life and what you need to focus on at the moment. Whenever you're thinking about decisions, think about what it is that you're looking for. Are you just financially motivated? Are you just financially driven? If so, you're just going to have to probably put up with the volatility in a tech industry if that's what's paying you your living wage of the moment. If not, if you have the luxury to be able to look at other things, and also your mental health. You know, if you've been through 4 rounds of layoffs and it's taken a toll on your personal health, physical, mental, emotional health, there's no compensation, or you're going to be needing to make a lot more compensation to pay for your therapy and medication moving forward. So be careful of that cycle too. You know, that is a cost. That's a real cost to working in an environment like that if you aren't wired for that.
You see, happiness is something people should look for in their work. Is that what you believe?
Try not to get too philosophical about this. I think that there isn't one answer. I think if you are happy doing what you do for a living and you make money at it, that's a win-win situation. What I said is that I don't think you should defer the responsibility for your happiness to an employer. I don't think you should defer your responsibility for your happiness to anyone in your life. You know, you're responsible for that. And so why give it to an employer? If you're unhappy there, you will have internal conflict, and that can also create physical sickness. And so why people stay in jobs while they're unhappy, to me, feels like self-punishment, self-neglect, and imprisonment. Look at the numbers. Industries are hiring. Might not be tech, but other industries are. You do have to network.
What industries would you recommend someone in tech who maybe wants to get out of tech? What are some ones you feel like would be natural for them? Like just natural fits for them? Farming? Ranching? Getting really out in the dirt? Probably not farming. Tell me, what do you think?
It's funny that you say farming, because there has been this pull back to the earth for a lot of people who've gone through the tech gauntlet. I think there's a farm in Wimberley now called Dirt Candy Farms, and I'm pretty sure that the founder or someone in the family who works the business came from tech, had a moment in their life that prompted the desire to emphasize the importance of farming and growing our own food and getting back to a healthier diet, an unprocessed diet. But anyway, tech people can be farmers. Absolutely. That's the beauty of technology and education and the information you can find online. We're in like kind of this entrepreneurial movement where it's becoming incredibly efficient and much easier to start your own business and to run your own business because you can learn just about anything you'd want to online. Now, whether or not you have the backing, the financial independence, the support to actually go do that thing is another element, but you can learn how to do that too. So, you know, I'm working right now as a mentor with the SKU Accelerator Program, which is a consumer packaged goods accelerator program. And the founders that I'm working with, there's about 10 of them, are just super inspiring to me. And a lot of them came from scenarios where they felt called to produce a product, or they felt jaded with the corporate, you know, 9-to-5 that they worked in. And they leveraged the resources that they had available to them, which is mostly hustle, grit. It's internal. You have to be internally motivated to do this, to build something. And you can get an AI designed site that you can edit and adjust for really low cost, low investment. You can get full branding packages for relatively low investment. Now, again, there's trade-offs to the finesse of those things. But if you're looking to do something yourself and get out of the tech industry altogether, or go be a farmer, or go do something that you thought you'd never really had the formal education to do, there are plenty of resources. And generally in Austin specifically, you'll find plenty of people who want to help you do that and will help you connect with other people who want to do that. Now, if you want to go be a cattle rancher in West Texas, you're probably going to find limited resources and competition. But that's the industry there. Just like if you want to start a tech company in Austin, it's probably going to be a little bit harder to do that just with the saturation and the competition here. Unless you are essential worker, healthcare worker, surgeon, you have to be educated and trained in those things. And you have to have years and years and years of practice. Most of your other skills in the private sector or in the corporate world can be transferable across industries. So if you're looking for a non-tech job, there's plenty out there just in different sectors. I would check the chamber website. I would check the Statesman, you know, check other local sources for those industries that are growing.
Very interesting. You know, when you talk about someone starting their own business, being entrepreneurial, I feel like quite a lot of the very long emotional posts I see on LinkedIn are people talking about businesses they're starting. It's like, this is me. I've been impacted by a layoff and I'm starting my own business. What do you think about that?
I think it's bold. I think it's courageous. I think it's how many successful businesses start. And I think it is one way, if you're able to leverage severance dollars to invest, there are countless tools that will help you get it up and running. And I'm speaking from personal experience now. So I was laid off in October 2023, I think it was, yes. And I recognized immediately that while the company I was with did not have the affordability structure for a chief people officer, they still had a need for some of my services. And so I parlayed my layoff conversation with the CEO into my first client. And I said, I hear what you're saying. If I were you and I were the CEO, I would say we probably don't need this role. We've got 10 other things that we need to work on to prioritize profitability in the near term. However, in that near term, you're going to need these services from an HR leader, and I'll do that for you at a retained rate of X. And I put it in front of them and they were like, that sounds great. Thank you. So I essentially turned my layoff conversation into my first contract, my first client. At that point in time, I reinvigorated my consulting business that I had started, planted a seed 10 years ago. And I said, let's keep this momentum going. I reached out to more people in my network that I had talked to throughout my career. I said, hey, I'm doing this. I got some connections from some former colleagues and have now grown my client base into something that is much more sustainable and freeing than a 9-to-5. Now, I've also met probably 5 other HR people who are doing fractional or contract work. I do think that a lot of HR processes are becoming automated and are becoming outsourced to technology or to external HR partners. There are a lot of companies that are like, hey, we're too small to hire full-time HR, but we do have needs that come up from time to time. So it's a niche that I found and I really enjoyed. So for people who have been laid off and want to start their own thing, I would say you have to dive all in and you have to differentiate yourself, because we're about to see this surge of independent contributors getting back to delivering value through outcomes versus just management. I do think AI is probably going to have a pretty big impact on middle management. And those people are either going to go back to individual contributor roles that feel a little bit more stable, or they're going to maybe go out on their own and start their own consulting practices or points of view.
I didn't realize I was talking to a laid off tech worker who started her own company.
It's me. Hi.
Are you nervous?
Sure. I think that's normal. I think if I wasn't nervous, I probably wouldn't be doing something right. I have to overcome not letting those nerves drive me back to safety in the form of another full-time job with a company that has this false promise of stability, right? So yeah, and I don't even know if I would just consider myself a tech worker. I've worked in advertising, I've worked in food and beverage, I've worked in tech, I've worked in design and consulting and public relations. So creative services generally. Did you know that I also started a queso business back in 2012?
A lot I did not know about you, Lindsay. Just tell me about this queso business. What?
Well, the queso business was short-lived because I realized that there's not a lot of money in the food industry. And I like to eat queso more than I liked to make it en masse. But I did some fun events. I am nervous, but I'm also hopeful, and I have really employed my network, a lot of people that I've met over my career. I also am fully aware that I have a partner who has health coverage, who has benefits that I could jump on in the interim. I have long been the carrier of our family's benefits coverage and that sort of thing. So I do have some other advantages or factors at play that might make my reality different from other people. By no means am I saying or insinuating that like that is the best path for everyone. There are a lot of factors at play, but the fact that I don't have to worry about all the self-employment stuff just yet, like benefits coverage and of course taxes. Yes, I need to worry about those, but we have dual income. And so that has definitely given me some relief and provided me some runway to really try this out. So I've given myself a year and I have a great network of mentors and cheerleaders in my corner, and I rely on them daily for inspiration and validation and also course correction. If I'm putting something out and they're like, did you think about it this way? Did you think about it that way? So I've curated my own company of people that I trust and that are smart, much smarter than I am. And they're willingly and graciously helping me do this thing.
Very interesting. So he says that was a plug. No, I don't let people plug their businesses on my podcast. Talking about it with you because it's relevant. Just, you know, Lindsay is an incredible person, and if you have hiring needs, just go to her. So you have two, I would say, really big advantages in starting your own company. One is obviously your spouse, who's an engineer. Sorry, software coder. Your spouse, who's an IT manager, who's going to pick a career that's very stable. IT management, pretty high up there. Pretty high up there. And also, you've been in many industries in HR for about 20 years. You have a huge book of contacts and people who've seen you be successful and would trust you with their business. What other factors are coming into play that might help you be successful? And also, what are some things that, you know, might result in failure? Tell me.
Ask me that question again in 6 months, because I'm only 6 months into this, and I think you have to have a social media presence, which I do not have. Admittedly, that is not a skill that I have learned yet. That is also something that generally you could outsource to AI. I have a friend who built a seven-figure business from scratch during the pandemic. It was a floral business, and she took it online and built this incredible community of independent florists. I lean on her a lot for tips and tricks and how to leverage the various ways to expand your reach and expand your customer base. That's just probably one of the things that keeps me up at night, is that I'm not fully utilizing all of social to its potential. Other advantages, like having a spouse or having dual income or having a partner or some sort of other safety net, definitely is the most critical. HR as a profession most transcends industry. It's not tech specific, agency specific. It's not finance specific. It's HR. It's a practice. So that's a bit of an advantage, is that my skill set can apply in lots of different industries. And then failure. Again, this might be a question for 6 months from now when we do a, did it work? Did it not work? And what are the lessons from it? But I think that if I'm being optimistic, I think that the allure of comfort often causes startups to fail. Meaning like it's not going to be comfortable. There's going to be a lot of unpredictability. You have to be able to roll with it and persevere through it and design better for it after you've gone through it, or hopefully before you go through it, if you can see it, because you can always get another job. It might not be your dream job. It might not be the job you want, but most of the time you can find another job somewhere. And it's getting back in that cycle of salary, benefits, employer that is very appealing to most of us in this culture. So to me, that would probably be one of my personal fears, or one of my perspectives on like a fear of a startup failing, outside of other things like market conditions and the economy and poor financial decisions or poor financial spending habits. Like all those things will tank you too. But getting out, networking, meeting people, sharing your ideas authentically, sincerely, and not giving into the allure of comfort, that should at least get you started off on the right foot.
Very interesting. You know, Lindsay, I have to say, the commonality I've noticed with most people who start their own businesses is just that they can't stomach working for other people. 9 times out of 10, when I talk to a small business owner, startup founder, whatever the kids are calling them these days, they do not like to be told what to do. I mean, most of us do not like to be told what to do, but how do I put this? So I took this personality, it was like a work inventory, and my workplace personality is the pioneer. I like doing things that are different and creative and innovative, but I do not mind working for someone else when I do them. In fact, I have to go find this test and show it to you. It's very interesting. Like, I do best when I'm building something for someone else. It's actually a big part of what my podcast is, right? Like, I'm telling other people's stories. I gotta be honest with you, Lindsay. You've always struck me as having that kind of personality too. I've never gotten that. She does not want to take direction from other people, or being told what to do is like disgusting to her.
I only laugh because whenever you say that, I'm thinking of like, I wonder if my mom or my husband would describe me this way. I can be pretty stubborn.
Oh, okay. So honestly, can you stomach working for other people? When someone tells you, Lindsay, do this, what happens in your body?
I actually have been fortunate enough to work with some of the most incredible mentors and teachers in my career. And because I approach everything as a learning experience, I'm always looking for what am I supposed to gain from this? How can I use this to build my offering forward?
No, Lindsay, this is not a job interview. What happens when someone just... Stop it. I've let you do this like the whole interview. No, just tell me when someone has given you a process and you maybe don't like it, but you've got to do it because they're your boss. What happens to your body?
Physically, I put it on my to-do list. Unless I disagree with it on a fundamental level, and then I will challenge it or ask questions or ask more about the reason why and the why behind the decision. And if I can't get behind it, I will try to convince the person that's delegating this to me otherwise, or provide alternate solutions for what might be trying to solve their problem. But I can't remember a time when I was told, do this. And morally and ethically, it did not align with my being, and I quit the job on the spot.
Yeah, there's our startup founder. What job was it? No, I can bleep it out. Just tell me and then I'll bleep it out. I want to know. You have to tell me everything. What company was it?
It was a company called... Ethically, I will not do that. There is an open investigation underway, and I would like to close that out before any decisions are made. And that was not what that person wanted to hear. And I said, you know, then in this instance where we agree to disagree, my disagreement means that I'm exiting this conversation. So I left.
I suspect, Lindsay, you're going to look back. Yeah, that's a startup. That's a startup founder personality trait, I would say. Not everyone would do that. I mean, the situation you're describing, which has been struck from the record and will be told to no one ever, 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 ever. Don't even think about asking me. Don't add me. Don't send me a LinkedIn post. Don't at me. Don't send me a text message. I'm not telling you. Secret. Lindsay's a good person. Very high amount of integrity. By the way, what they're talking about is not illegal. It's not grotesque. It's just a fundamental business practice that conflicted with Lindsay's ethics system. A lot of people might do it and then just have a drink later and feel really bad about it, but ultimately go, oh, it wasn't me. It was the company. You were not like that.
No, I wasn't. I think that when you reach a certain point in your career, you have developed certain points of view and practices that drive your value to a person or a business or a company. And you have to stick with what's made you successful as part of who you are. And so, yeah, I, again, had created a little buffer, as I would advise anybody, especially with massive tech layoffs, to do. I had created a buffer that if I needed to do something like this ever, if I needed to get out of a bad situation at work, I could do that. And I could have runway to go find what's next. So again, it wasn't like I threw caution to the wind and wasn't able to pay my mortgage and, you know, that sort of thing. It was responsibly done, but ethically driven.
Okay, Lindsay, I know we are coming up on time, but I do have just one final question for you. I feel like I don't know a lot of these things about you, like the fact that you started a queso business or that you were laid off from your tech job. because you don't make long LinkedIn posts expressing everything that has ever happened to you in life and where you're going and what skills you built. As someone who's worked in HR for 20 years, what do you think about people who write long expository pieces about themselves? We'll go on LinkedIn and write, not so sad to leave this company. These are the skills I built. Excited to join this company for these things, like short, normal posts on social, on LinkedIn. LinkedIn specifically. What is your opinion on that?
Well, I can't say that I've read one in a very long time.
Have you logged on to LinkedIn? Here, no, we'll pull one up real quick. I'm not going to read it because that's mean. That's cyberbullying and I don't know what's going on in someone's life. Okay, I found one. So this person is talking about how they have gone through 4 rounds of layoffs. They have been out of a job for a year and they are at their maximum. This post is literally the size of my phone. They're sharing their mental health struggles, their personal life struggles, the people that are depending on them. It's very heartfelt and sad. I'm not judging this person for posting this, but I have to wonder, as someone who's in hiring, when you look at something like that, what does that say to you?
Well, first of all, I feel for that person. That 4 times, again, back to the volatility, you can stomach it or you can't. But your LinkedIn is your resume, right? Like a lot of recruiters will just use LinkedIn links. And so you have to think about the intention of what you're trying to post, what you hope to gain from your post. I see it in the same vein as like posting really lengthy cries for help on Facebook or on Instagram. LinkedIn is another version, but LinkedIn is your resume. LinkedIn is searchable and recruiters can see everything. And that's the purpose for which it's used. You just have to be mindful that anything you post that is public is fair game for interpretation by whomever is reading it. So that interjects bias into the brain. You know, recruiters are not robots yet. So you can't automate that out of it. If a recruiter reads it, I'm sure they might have a perspective on it. We can't just scrub that from our memory. We can be aware of it. They just have to know that that has potential consequences. And this is where the high road comes into play and being mindful of bridges burned comes into play as well. I don't know what the intent is, like trying to spark change in an industry, trying to spark a movement. You know, there are different ways to go about doing that, sending out a plea for an interview or in desperation. I saw another post that I thought was actually a really self-aware post. It's not like this one you just described, but it was like, hey, I've been laid off a couple of times. I'm not getting really specific feedback on why I was selected, or I'm getting rejected in interviews, or I'm not getting callbacks, and I'm not getting enough specific feedback to act on. Would anybody in my network be willing to set up time with me to provide any feedback or advice or perspective that I may be missing that could help me achieve my goals of getting hired in this industry? So it was more like, here's my reality. Here's what I'm asking from my community and my network. So they turned it into a self-development exercise versus a lamenting or venting. I think from a recruiter perspective, I would like to think from a human perspective, you would read that and say, oh, okay, they're taking a situation and trying to learn from it and apply that forward. I don't know what you gain off of venting posts other than this validation that you're craving. Does that make sense?
Yes, and thank you for giving me the real answer and not the diplomatic HR answer. Speaking of which, we're coming up on time, Lindsay. You've been such a great guest. Thank you so much for coming on my show. No, you're not out of the woods yet. No.
Okay.
You touched on the reason why a little earlier that it might scratch an itch, but anyone who goes on LinkedIn, I feel like, knows that making a long post about your mental health or something going on in your life, it's not a good idea. I mean, we're at a point now where I feel like everyone has a decent amount of internet education. Like, don't send a message that you're not comfortable with 100 people reading is a pretty good baseline, especially when you're using LinkedIn or a more professional social media. Like, I'd say Twitter has a level of professionalism. That is something that was really impressed upon me at a very early age. Clearly, there is a right behavior and there is a behavior. And you might say, oh, there's not. Yeah, there kind of is if you want to be employable in America. Why do people engage in behaviors that are clearly not good for them, that they know are not good, that could cost them potential employment opportunities? Why do people do that?
I have a theory, and that is it's either validation or vindication. So generally when people post these lengthy posts about what's going on in their life, they are trying to vindicate themselves from a situation, meaning provide an excuse or a reason or a proactive idea in the minds of others as to why they may be acting erratically or emotionally or severely to a certain outcome. So vindication or validation, and maybe a little bit of both, like you want people to validate your feelings. I also agree with you. LinkedIn is not the forum for posting something that you wouldn't actually also share in an interview with your potential future employer.
I guess if that's the one piece of advice you're going to get from this podcast, it is, I think, the best thing you can do post layoff. It's to present yourself honestly, but also in the best light that you can. Because, I mean, it's not a pretty job market, Lindsay. It's getting pretty rough out there. What words of encouragement would you give to people who are really impacted by layoffs and looking for work, for any work?
Network. And that means online and in person. Attend events, get out in your community, participate in your community in interesting ways. It doesn't always have to be centered around a job. Getting social, like in real life, can help create connections and form bonds. This is extremely hard for introverts and a little bit easier for extroverts, but it's very important. And also try different things with your resume. Go out on coffee dates. That's what I say. Like, ask people for coffee. Like, say, hey, I want to talk to you about the job market. Let's go grab coffee. Dialogue moves people into new positions. I truly believe that. So I don't think you can hide behind a computer screen and just apply for 1,000 jobs and expect that to be the only thing that works. You have to put physical, social effort out there and try a different industry. Look at your skill set. Try a different industry. Search LinkedIn by skills and see if that results any different. Also, here's a plug. I don't even know if it's really a plug. It's a plugin. It's called Clearbit, and it is a Chrome browser plugin. I'm sure they have it on other browsers, but I use it on Chrome. And you can go to any website, and if you have this plugin installed, it will pull up the contact information for most senior level employees in that organization, and even down into like the marketing teams, the HR teams, the tech teams, and it scrapes the back end of their site as well as pulls in LinkedIn data. So that's also a good e-commerce tool, and it's a good prospecting tool. So if you run a business and you're looking for clients and you want to like get right into the CMO's inbox or you want to do something like that, you can use this tool and you can send direct messages. So I've had plenty of people reach out and say, hey, I found you. You know, here, I found you there. And I generally will get back to just about every message that I get. So, you know, you can leverage other aspects as well in forms of proactive outreach rather than just scraping job boards. Because I don't know what's going on with the job boards, but people are not getting jobs by applying online these days, it seems. I don't know what that's all about.
It's about the hokey pokey. Said it's off. No, what to say. It's drama, hokey pokey. I feel like sometimes when you're networking with people, it's kind of like a hokey pokey. It's like shake hands, say hello.
That's a really good analogy. So we've got Lay's potato chips and the hokey pokey.
I really am like a child with a big phone. How I feel all the time. Thank you so much for coming on my show, Lindsay. It was really very fascinating.
Thank you. That's the first time that anyone's ever described HR as fascinating, and I have appreciated it. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to more topics.
This is the most HR answer anyone's ever given me as a goodbye for my podcast. All right. Bye, everybody. Lindsay and I are going to go eat ice cream.
promise I won't cry.
Why?
'Cause I'm on the other side. And now that we said goodbye.